From the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, KUAR Public Radio brings you Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of comparative generational thought, with your host, Phil Marriage. Welcome to the Crossroads of History.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this very special 2013 edition of Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. If you followed our programs, you know that our normal format is to have a guest from the older and the middle and the younger generation for each of our topics that we do. And from time to time, and by the way, this is the third that we've done it this way in 13 years, I do come across a guest who has written or is focused on a topic that really sheds light on all of our generations, both the living generations and those from the past. And this evening's program is just one such topic like that. And let me also tell you that this will be part two. But if you'd like to hear the entire interview, you can go to the podcast, which is at our website at yttshow.org. And it's also going to be on iTunes. In recent years, we've seen and we've heard much about the polarization, the red and the blueness of our society. And we think that it didn't used to be so strained and strident. And in fact, a couple hours ago, just before I left to come up to do the program today, I overheard a conversation between a couple of people in the store. And they were talking about how in their youth, when they were growing up, we weren't as we are now, that things used to be a lot more American. I knew what I was coming up against here today in discussing this book. And I know that it's not quite that way. And our author will tell you a little bit more. My special guest this evening is author Colin Woodard, whose recent book has fascinated me in how it relates not only to the historical nature of our divergent cultures, but also to the current and the future attitudes that we have about each other today even. American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America is the book, and it's published by Penguin Books, and Colin Woodard joins us from his home in Portland, Maine. Colin, welcome to Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow.
Thank you for having me.
Colin Woodard is a writer, a historian, and award-winning journalist who has reported for more than 50 foreign countries and six continents. He's a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor and the Chronicle for Higher Education, and his work has appeared in The Economist, Smithsonian, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Washington Post, Newsweek, The Daily Beast, and many more publications. And he's also the author of Lobster Coast, The Republic of Pirates, and Ocean's End. Colin, I want to begin the program with you today talking about what I just mentioned a second ago about this conversation I heard. And I know in your book you speak about the difference between the myth of what we've been taught over the generations of how we came together as a unified country. And in fact, it may be a little bit different than that. And I'd also want to mention that as our program is broken up into two parts, I want to spend the first portion of our program talking about the 11 regions and have you discuss with us how they impact those generations of that time, how people were then, how the regionalization was. Again, it's a fascinating book, and I want to give you all the time in the world to tell us more about what we should know, really, about the various parts of our country.
Oh, my pleasure. The short answer is that there's never really been one America, but several Americas, and their rival cultural traditions and their answers to the great American questions about what is the American identity and what are the real American ideals and the intents for the country, they each have their own answers. And sometimes those answers aren't compatible, and they actually are the background that fuel some of our most fiery and ever-recurring debates over things like, you know, what's the real meaning of liberty or freedom? Or are we an Anglo-Protestant nation that immigrants should assimilate into some kind of Anglo-Protestant dominant culture that we supposedly have? Or are we a mosaic of different cultures and people bringing things from different parts of the world that can coexist side by side? Now, those are all legitimate American ideals, but each of them comes from a different regional culture. So that's the ultimate thesis in the book, and that these regional cultures date back to the early colonial period when the first clusters of colonies were being settled by entirely disparate groups of people.
We've spent a good deal of time talking about the eastern portion of the country, and I know there were sections of your book dealing with El Norte and the far west, and you mentioned the left coast. Let's move a little bit further west. Let's expand what your book talks about, the other cultures that really could have changed a lot had history taken a little different twist. In fact, one of the questions I had for you was, given that the Spanish began their quest into our continent so early on, if they'd have been a little bit more successful and hadn't had to deal with some of their own things at home, they might have changed the outlook of the whole thing.
Possibly. I think even more so if we, the English-speaking American cultures, had been less successful, they might have had the space to have conquered a larger and held down a larger portion of the continent than they were ultimately able to. The culture I called El Norte, which is the sort of Spanish borderlands, it extends in, you know, sort of about 100 miles on either side of the current U.S.-Mexico border. It includes, you know, these cultures don't respect state boundaries. They also don't respect international ones. These all flow into Canada and in this case, into the northern provinces of Mexico. And the problem for this, or the, what distinguished this culture, was also a challenge for it in that this was the farthest northern extension of Spain's empire in the New World. And this was occurring much earlier. I mean, they were coming in and, you know, settling some of the cities of this northern part of Mexico and the southwest in the United States in the late 1500s and early years of the 1600s. And by the time the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock, the Spanish were already writing, you know, their first history of Taos, New Mexico, you know, in 1610. So it occurred very early. And in that technology and environment, they were so remote in travel times from the rest of Mexico. I mean, they were traveling with wooden ox carts over trails and trailless areas. It would take months for supplies and therefore news and communications to get from Mexico City to these places. And imagine how much longer it would take to get word from Spain. So these places were extremely isolated, and because of that, formed many of their own characteristics. I mean, we're used to thinking of the Spanish Southwest as being, you know, different from the rest of the United States, and that Hispanic culture and food and language and such dominate. But I think what many of us Americans fail to realize is that this El Norte area is looked upon by Mexicans as being very strange. The northern provinces are seen as being a totally different place than the rest of Mexico, a place more work-centered, more democratic-minded. Many of the leaders of the Mexican Revolution and other reform movements throughout Mexican history have come from these provinces. And it's a place that never looked towards Mexico City, but always looked eastwards and northwards for its trading partners, and has made many efforts throughout even the Mexican period to secede from Mexico and form third-party independent states in between. There was the Republic of the Rio Grande, and indeed there was the Republic of Texas. We all know that Texas seceded and was independent for a little while, but what is often appreciated is that it wasn't just, you know, Austin and these various Anglos who moved into the Mexican province of Texas who did that. They were backed and supported by the entire Spanish-speaking leadership of Texas. They wanted to form a third state and a third way in between. And indeed, you know, a lot of people feel that if the Mexican Federation does indeed fail and fall apart in generations to come, that the northern tier of provinces would probably want to break off and form its own third country sort of in between those two places. The brief answer to your question is it was difficult for that, but the population was always sparse in the regions they did succeed of colonizing in what's now the United States, and it made it very difficult for them to resist the far larger numbers that would come to those regions from the East, English and generally English-speaking people. And then the rest of the west of the U.S. is dominated by two regional cultures, and these are the first ones that we've been talking about, specific, you know, distinct ethnographic cultures brought from different parts of Europe, from different parts of the British Isles or from the Netherlands or from Spain. In this case, these are two cultures that they're second-generation ones. They're creations of the other American cultures, and they both date to the mid and late 19th century. And the first one that was created was actually on the West Coast, a place I call the Left Coast, which is a skinny Chile-shaped nation wedged between the mountains and the Pacific Ocean. So it's a long, narrow nation that starts in San Francisco and just creeps along the coast all the way up through Northern California, Oregon, Washington, coastal British Columbia, and even up into Juneau, Alaska. And it's a very different place in the interior of the West. This Left Coast area was essentially a hybrid of two cultures that settled it. One were Yankees, New Englanders, who arrived by sea, going in ships around Cape Horn and arriving on the coast, and settled the towns. And they were coming specifically and explicitly in their writings to try to form a new New England on the Pacific and to to carry forth their cultural values of New England to these far westward edges of the continent. And they saw their journey as around Cape Horn as being a repeat of the Mayflower voyage, and that they were going to create a new light on the hill in the west and then, you know, go on to bring the New England away to China or who knows where. But they did not succeed entirely because there was a separate group of people who arrived overland in wagon trains over the unsettled and incredibly dangerous and enormous expanses of the interior west. And most of these people tended to come from the Appalachian parts of the Midwest, from southern Ohio and Indiana and Illinois and northern parts of Missouri. And they tended to settle the countryside and, of course, had a completely different set of values. They were in the mining camps and into the mountains. And the result has been this hybrid culture between the two that captures that Yankee utopianism, yes, we can make the world a better place through social engineering, with the Appalachian emphasis on, you know, individual self-actualization, and the product has been rather fecund. I mean, think about all the major high-tech companies who dominate the planet, from, you know, Microsoft and Apple to Google and Facebook and so on and so forth. Every single one of them is in that area I just described on the left coast, either around Silicon Valley or up around Puget Sound in Washington. So there's that culture, and it is a completely different place from the interior west, which extends through much of the mountain west, the northern parts of Arizona, most of Nevada, and even parts of upper plains states from about the 100th parallel over. It's an enormous part of the continent. What defines it together, this is the one part of the continent which is not defined by ethnography, but by the incredible harshness of the environment that the early settlers encountered when they arrived in the late 19th century. It's arid, it's high altitude, it was incredibly remote, and the distances were so enormous that situation and the environmental situation was so difficult that their ways, their folk ways of these eastern societies of growing food and conducting agriculture were just stopped in their tracks. You needed enormous amounts of capital to survive there. You needed huge irrigation projects and dams. You needed giant, you know, mining apparatus and smelters and such to mine things. And you needed railways stretched over hundreds and hundreds and thousands of miles of nothingness to get access to markets and to bring people there. Unlike the rest of the continent, that essentially it was entirely, colonization was reliant on massive industrial-scale capital, either brought by the federal government itself or brought by big companies based in the other nations on the coast, railway companies and mining companies, the Anaconda Coppers of the world and the, you know, Hearsts and the Union Pacific Railroad and so on and so forth. And those companies and the federal government, the rest of us, essentially treated the whole area as an internal resource colony. The railways tended to guide settlement. They were given grants. They would, other parts of the continent, you know, if you founded a couple towns and eventually after, you know, decades or centuries, the towns got big enough, somebody would come along and build a railway connecting them. Not so in the far west. There, the railway companies built the railway first. They decided where the towns would be, and they contracted back in Europe often. They recruited settlers to go to those places, gave them through tickets. It would bring them on ships across the Atlantic and then straight onto trains. It would bring them out to their new home. So it was actually guided by the outside world. But they exploited it as a resource colony and tried to keep it as such in many, many ways. And that's led to enormous resentment within the far west of both the federal government and some of these Anaconda Coppers and other companies that ruled over the region. And so the region has often oscillated between populism in the early 20th century, it was against a lot of the big corporate tycoons, or swinging to the being skeptical against the federal government, which controls much of the land and decides what happens on much of it. And that's currently what has it allied with the sort of southern bloc in contemporary American politics, is a shared anger and resistance to federal control. And then there's two other nations that briefly, they only have small bits of territory within the United States, but dominate Canada. One is New France, created by Champlain in the early 1600s, and very different from France itself. It's sort of an amalgam of the folk ways of early northern French peasantry and the folk ways of the Indians they encountered in the St. Lawrence Valley, and very different place than France itself was at the time. It's egalitarian and always forming consensus and having negotiations that never end, about just maintaining the negotiation is sort of the way of of conducting business in and of itself, and that's some characteristics which New France and Quebec have actually passed on to the Canadian Federation, where all of those things are sort of prized Canadian values. And then finally, the last nation, or maybe it's the youngest nation or the oldest, depending on how you look at it, is this sprawling nation that covers the far north of Canada from halfway up, you know, Alberta and Quebec and Ontario and so on, all the way up through the Canadian Shield, and includes the upper half of Alaska and even Greenland. And that's an area I call First Nation, which has always remained under the control of the Native American inhabitants who've been there the whole time, and who, because of their remoteness, nobody ever got around to forcing them to sign over their land to anybody. And so in the current circumstance, Canada and Denmark and to some extent the United States have all realized, you know, I guess you guys still do own this land, or it's sovereign to you. And they're starting to have enormous control over what happens in the far north with its staggering resources, mineral and fossil fuels and so on and so forth. And these are many of the people are Inuit-speaking, the people we used to call the Eskimos, and they've, to some extent, still maintain the ability to survive with their own folkways in an incredibly difficult environment. And they now control kind of a sovereign territory in Canada, Nunavut.
Well, Colin Woodard, you've taken us in a very brief effort here to get around the entire continent here in discussing how the different cultures came together. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask one question that pertains to that older time and then even to our current time, having to do with immigration. This whole thing has to do with people coming here for various reasons. If you would, can you talk to me about the blending or the mixing or however you want to call it of the various cultures that we had in that past history from an immigration standpoint, and then bring us into your perspective for the future?
Yeah, I mean, the one legitimate question everyone ought to ask of this kind of thesis is, hey, you know, there have been all these waves of immigration. Certainly these cultures you just described got diluted and run over long ago as millions and tens of millions of people not from those cultures poured into our country and should have, you know, caused these things, these older dominant cultures to disappear. But that's not the case. It is true that immigration waves that the rest of us have arrived in large numbers, but what we confronted when we arrived in these places were these dominant cultural attitudes that were already there, and maybe we liked it or didn't like it. We may have added things from cultures we brought with us, and that's excellent. But over time, as our children and our grandchildren were raised in these places, they tend to assimilate into the culture around them. And my argument is that culture was not an American culture, in quotes, but one of these regional cultures, right down to the dialect of English that the grandchildren will speak. And so that in the long run, these cultures end up winning out, and that you see that in sort of empirical evidence all over the place, from the who could be more considered more New England than the Kennedys, who are, of course, Irish Catholic immigrants, were reviled by the early Protestant Yankee English. But, you have over time, those cultural values, things get altered slightly, but still those dominant strains seem to have held and carried through. So your question was about the blending and such, and more cultures come and people come, and that's excellent. I'm saying, the same thing occurs in France and in Italy and in England. And, the English people have great curry, thank goodness, and has brought, the empire has brought people and things which have enriched England, but it's still England. And France, the same thing, its empire's brought in people from all over the world, but over time there's distinctive French values that hold through, even as the country becomes more diverse and has more cultural enclaves and exposure. I'm saying that it's the same principles that work in our continent. We're just not used to recognizing them. And it gets confusing because two of our regional cultures champion the fact that there is no dominant culture, that their values in New Netherland and the Midlands are that we are multicultural and pluralistic. And so that idea of, bring our, immigrants from all over the world should come and we'll have this diverse mixing, and that's the goal, is that that's part of two regional cultures believe that entirely. But that's not an accepted goal in some of the other regional cultures where the assumption is that the immigrants will come in and assimilate into our way, and our way is not pluralism, if you know what I mean. So that's it depends on where you arrive as an immigrant, what the assumptions about assimilation are, the dominant assumptions are. And they've been very different depending on whether you arrived in Charleston or in Arkansas or in Maine or in Philadelphia or St. Louis. You know, it would be a very different take on what it would mean to become American.
Well, given that we live in an instantaneous time frame now of communications and technology, my question then is, we've heard so much recently about the red and blueness of our country, of America. Are we really red and blue, and are we going to stay red and blue? And if we are red and blue, what does red and blue mean, really, from your regional standpoint?
I guess we are red and blue in quotes, but if you go back, you could look at the 1960s, you know, and when I give talks, I show some slides on a county level, you know, what the red-blue map looks like on a county level, and we're used to seeing that map now. But the first slide I threw up was familiar, the way that it plays and follows the American nations. You have one color, you have the solid block in New England, and across much of upstate New York, the western reserve of Ohio, and so on and so forth, set against southern Ohio, and except the colors are reversed. You know, if you go back to the 1916 electoral map, the Republican red states and the red counties and the Democratic blue counties they're the absolute opposite. So the parties change over time, but the regional differences do not. So that's kind of the key. And we do have two, in contemporary terms, and for the past 40 years, we've had two recognizable blocks, where you have Yankeedom and New Netherland and the left coast in a sort of strong blue alliance and tend to vote together and share a common platform on the great questions of the age, set against a red, reliable red bloc, which has been Appalachia and the Deep South and until recently Tidewater and the far west. But if you do the math on population and electoral votes and congressional seats and even to some extent Senate seats, at least for a filibuster-proof majority, neither of those blocks by themselves can dominate the levers of federal power. And the battle has been for the sort of unaligned swing nations in between, particularly the Midlands, which has been ambivalent and torn between which side they want to back in the questions of the day, which is why the big swing states have continually been Ohio and Missouri and Pennsylvania, is because those are places with large Midland blocks. So we've been living for decades now right on an edge where everybody's fighting at the 50-yard line. One side will win temporarily and the other side will get pushed back, and there's this enormous tension. But there is absolutely a red block and a blue block, in quotes, which really are representing two regional coalitions. And the fight is over the sort of the swing voters in between. And it's a struggle that includes sort of definitions of, and, you know, what's the proper balance between church and state, between federal and local power, between individual freedom and the communal good or community freedom. All those questions that regional cultures have very different takes on, and they have all sorts of policy implications.
So the statement, the more things change, the more things stay the same.
Yeah, or as I like to say, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
With the time that you've spent studying this and talking about it in various ways, the question surely has to come up, what do you think about the long-term aspects of what you've studied? Do you see a time when there will be any change, or are we destined to just stay in these divergent you, me, us, them kind of thing?
These things have flared up and then settled down, flared up and settled down. We're in a flared-up situation. And when things settle down, it's usually through the brutal reality that one political grouping or the other is able to successfully form a coalition which blocks the opposing bloc out of the levers of federal power. And it's happened a number of times through our history. And right now, we haven't had that for some time. So neither grouping has any kind of control. The way we will get out of our current tightrope is that one political formation or the other, presumably it's going to be the two parties we have today, the Democrats or Republicans, one of those will succeed in not just changing their messaging, but changing their actual policies that they advocate enough to form a lasting coalition that will allow them to dominate Washington, have a filibuster-proof Senate majority, to have the presidency, and to have a majority in the House of Representatives. And there's different strategies for the Democrats and Republicans to do it. In very short, I think the Democrats' opportunity is in the Midlands and perhaps the far west. It would have to do with retooling an argument towards fairness, which would play strongly in the far west about the economy and the tax code and the like. Identity politics won't work in the far west very successfully. And for the Republicans, the big opportunity would be to jettison the sort of whites first kind of atmosphere that has scared off Hispanic voters, especially in El Norte, who George W. Bush, when president, recognized that Hispanics might well, and that El Norte might well be a natural Republican voting bloc, family-oriented, conservative, religious culture, and that that could naturally be, the entrepreneurial spirit, that could naturally fall in with the Republican Party. But they've been sort of alienated because the sort of notion that, through immigration debates and otherwise, that you're not really Americans or that everyone should speak English and all those arguments, which are going to lose you El Norte. So for the Republicans, if they were able to retool that in order to become attractive across racial lines and with minorities and reach out that appeal, they would have enormous opportunities in El Norte, which might gain them a great deal of strength. The Deep South and Yankeedom are never going to agree on anything. We're not going to ever have consensus on that level. It's more one grouping or the other blocking the other out on the federal level.
Whereas we came together to fight a revolutionary war with divergent views to succeed in the future, this dialectic has to happen, from what you're saying, to come together to do whatever we need in the future that might be just as big.
Yeah, an external threat will bring us all together instantly again. World War II, and there's lots of other examples. And sometimes, there'll be something that you get broad agreement on. Pockets of resistance on a regional level, but, FDR's second term or Ronald Reagan's and the Reagan Revolution, you look at the presidential maps and it's a solid sea of one color or the other.
Right.
So you have situations where everyone, will sometimes agree, or you'll have an external threat that has everyone grouped together.
Your book is so fascinating to me, and I really wanted to share it with our audience here.
I'm very pleased to have spoken with you and hope that was useful and that my roll call of the nations was not too exhaustive for your readers. It's hard to say it any tighter than that and have it be meaningful.
Well, I think the listeners, as they're hearing, will have been able to discover who they are and how they might fit into what you've been talking about here today.
Well, very good. Well, I thank you very much for your interest.
Well,
thanks for having me.
Do you also, your book is available through Amazon?
Yeah, Amazon should be in, Barnes & Noble's everywhere, and, it's generally should be available most places books are sold, and definitely Amazon. It's in paperback and hardcover now.
Well, again, we've been talking today with Colin Woodard, who is the author of American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. We've taken quite a bit of time over these two programs to discuss the various ways the cultures have come together and been apart, and I've really enjoyed talking with Colin about it. Colin, thanks so much for sharing your book with us here, and I hope if those of you are listening, if you're at all into history, you'd like to hear a little bit more about it, read a little bit more about it, you can get the book at Amazon, or you can listen to the entire podcast of our program here at our show, yttshow.org. Thanks again, Colin, and I'll let you go.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Our special guest last week and this week has been author Colin Woodard, whose very enlightening book has been the focus of our discussion, American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. If you've enjoyed these two programs and you want to hear more, download the podcast at our site, yttshow.org, or on iTunes. Again, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is a production of KUAR Public Radio, Little Rock.